This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Tom Perata, is the author of the novels Election and Little Children, which were both adapted into films. His novel The Leftovers was adapted into an HBO series. His new novel, Mrs. Fletcher, has already been optioned by HBO for a possible series. The story is about major life transitions and the sexual transitions that accompany them. When the novel begins, Eve, a 46-year-old divorced single mother, is saying goodbye to her son Brendan, who's leaving for college. He expects college to be a big beer and pizza party with plenty of girls. He's unprepared for the way he'll be called out for his sexist behavior. Meanwhile, Eve, facing the freedom and loneliness of the empty nest, signs up for a community college class called Gender and Society, a Critical Perspective, taught by a trans woman. Although Eve has been worried about the influence of porn on how her son treats young women, she finds herself turning to porn and is surprised by how much she starts to like it. In a review of Mrs. Fletcher in Newsday, Marion Winnick wrote, "Perata has been called the Steinbeck of suburbia and an American Chekhov, but with Mrs. Fletcher, he's become the Jane Austen of 21st century sexual mores." Terry Gross spoke to Tom Perata last week. A note to parents, although they talk a little about how the main character becomes drawn to porn, they don't talk explicitly about the porn she watches.
Tom Perata, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want to ask you to start by reading from the very beginning of Mrs. Fletcher.
Okay. It was a long drive, and Eve cried most of the way home because the big day hadn't gone the way she'd hoped. Not that big days ever did. Birthdays, holidays, weddings, graduations, funerals. They were all too loaded with expectations, and the important people in her life rarely acted the way they were supposed to. Most of them didn't even seem to be working from the same script as she was, though maybe that said more about the important people in her life than it did about big days in general. Take today. All she'd wanted from the moment she opened her eyes in the morning was a chance to let Brendan know what was in her heart, to express all the love that had been building up over the summer, swelling to the point where she sometimes thought her chest would explode. It just seemed really important to say it out loud before he left, to share all the gratitude and pride she felt, not just for the wonderful person he was right now, but for the sweet little boy he'd been, and the strong and decent man he would one day become. And she wanted to reassure him, too, to make it clear that she would be starting a new life just the same as he was, and that it would be a great adventure for both of them. "Don't worry about me," she wanted to tell him. "You just study hard and have fun. I'll take care of myself." But that conversation never happened. Brendan had overslept. He'd been out late partying with his buddies, and when he finally dragged himself out of bed, he was useless, too hungover to help with the last-minute packing or the loading of the van. It was just so irresponsible, leaving her with her bad back to lug his boxes and suitcases down the stairs in the sticky August heat, sweating through her good shirt while he sat in his boxers at the kitchen table, struggling with the childproof cap on a bottle of ibuprofen. But she managed to keep her irritation in check. She didn't want to spoil their last morning together with petty nagging, even if he deserved it. Going out on a sour note would have been a disservice to both of them.
That's Tom Perata reading from his new novel, Mrs. Fletcher. So I love that you have these two parallel transitions. Mother's transition, the single mother's transition, when her son is leaving for college, and his transition when he is the one who's leaving. And there's so many points in this book where I think he's being so oblivious to her needs. And I thought back to myself when I left for college. I wasn't thinking about my parents' needs. I didn't ask them, "How do you feel now that I'm leaving home?" It never would have occurred to me.
No, you assume they're all right. Their stories are set, and you're the one who's on the adventure.
Exactly. And that's part of the point of your book. The mother's story is not set. Like, she's questioning who she is. She's questioning her sexual orientation. She's questioning what kind of life she wants to have, how she should shake up her life. She goes back to community college and takes a course on basically, like, sex and gender. So what got you thinking about these two parallel transitions, the mothers and the sons, and how you could kind of join them together?
Well, the first part of it is I think that I've been kind of tracking my own life in my fiction. So when my kids were little and on the playground, I wrote little children based on those experiences. And when they were playing sports in junior high and high school, that gave me some of the raw material for the abstinence teacher. And the most recent era of my life has been this transition to the empty nest and to this post-parental moment of reflection. Like, okay, this huge project of raising kids is over. What does my life look like now? What does her life look like as well? But I never really write straight autobiography, and it seemed like a much more poignant thing to reflect on what it would be like for a woman whose son was the other person in her family. She really is alone when he goes to school. The empty nest really is empty for her.
Well, another thing that really sets off the story, it's on that day that she's about to drive him to college for his first day there. The girlfriend who her son has broken up with comes over for a visit. So the mother, Eve, goes out to get gas before driving him to college. When she returns, she hears that they're engaged in a sexual act, and he's giving her, her son is giving his girlfriend, really his ex-girlfriend, these crude sexual commands about what to do to him, calling her the B word. And Eve is just like appalled. Like she's an enlightened woman. Like she hates this language. She hates everything it stands for. And she doesn't know how to have that conversation with him, and certainly doesn't want to have it with him on the day that they're parting, that he's going to college. But she wants him to begin college with the understanding that there's a difference between sexual relationships in real life and the soulless encounter he presumably watches on the internet. So what made you think about that? Does that come out of your life, too, of wanting to make sure that your children weren't learning crude, condescending ways of speaking to their boyfriend or girlfriend, from either learning it from friends, from television, from porn, whatever?
Well, I just think it's a really interesting and peculiar moment in American culture, because on the one hand, there is this kind of crudeness in the way that we talk. And on the other hand, there's this conflicting urge to really police the way that we speak. And so you see it with, the B word, as you said. But so it's very common to hear women laughingly refer to their friends with that word. But then there's a sense that, a guy should never say it to a woman. And you might say, well, that's a clear rule, but it's also a confusing rule, and I think it's a shock for Eve to hear her son use this word in a sexual context. And I think she immediately thinks that he learned it from porn, where because he certainly wouldn't have anybody modeling that kind of language for him in real life.
So, she's assuming her son watches porn. And then once he's out of the house, she starts watching a lot of porn. And would you describe the kind of porn she's especially interested in?
Yeah, well, she receives an anonymous text that applies a certain label to her, which you and I have agreed to say she's a sexy mom, a mom who is sexually desirable. People will know the acronym. And she's offended by it. And it's a dirty text. But at the same time, she realizes she's not really sure about what the term means. And she goes to look it up the way we do. And she realizes that it's not quite the old Mrs. Robinson stereotype. It's a more neutral and possibly even complimentary term, suggesting that, you may be older, you may be a mom, but you're still desirable. And in the course of doing this, she's led to a website that basically consists of ordinary women in their 30s and 40s, sending in, or their husbands or their partners, sending in videos of them engaged in sex. So it's highly amateur, And it's just about people saying, hey, this is me. Here you can get a glimpse into my bedroom.
And she's surprised to find herself watching lesbian porn.
Yes, you know, she samples the menu, which is vast. And at a certain point, she settles on this lesbian porn as, you know, she's never thought of herself in this way, but this porn turns her on, and I think it leads her to sense that there are sexual possibilities in her world that she hasn't investigated yet.
In the sexy mother category of lesbian porn, you describe it as often beginning with a reluctant woman grumpily washing dishes or mopping the floor when the doorbell rings, and then a more confident woman arrives with a bottle of wine and a bit of exposed cleavage, and then the action begins. Did you watch a lot of this before writing the novel?
I watched enough to write the novel. Yeah, I did. And it was really interesting because, you know, people have different responses to porn, obviously, and some of it is, you know, disturbing, and some of it is just too much. But I did find that I was especially interested by this category of porn that involved a kind of a seduction, because it was, I think, very different from, you know, the stereotypical male porn that would just sometimes just launch right in. You know, nobody wants any talking. But there was this sense that, you know, and I guess maybe this is a definition of a certain kind of female-friendly porn, that it was about two people connecting and about, it was about seduction, actually, very clearly.
And then in contrasting that with her son, with Eve's son, he grows up in a boy culture where date rape doesn't seem like it's necessarily wrong to the boys. And if you're a guy who tries to intervene and stop date sexual harassment or date rape, you're going to be bullied for it. And it makes it very confusing for the boys, I think. And I'd like to know what you were thinking about when you were writing this character who is kind of subscribing to that kind of behavior and language and not really understanding what's wrong with it, even though he grows up in a family that wouldn't tolerate that kind of behavior.
Right, and he would say that it was wrong if you asked him about it. And I do think that I was really interested in the fact that, you know, we talk way more about consent than we did when I was in college.
When were you in college, by the way?
I graduated in 1983, you know, I think a whole sort of body of knowledge, you know, or just even the category of sexual harassment didn't fully exist. Like, I think I certainly knew students who'd had affairs with teachers, and that was sort of considered, you know, a little bit risky, but not beyond the pale. And you know, it just hadn't been codified as an offense at that point. It would soon change, but I will say, you know, we didn't speak as much about consent. We didn't speak as much about sexual boundaries. I think we were closer to the sexual revolution. It was right at the moment when AIDS started to really change people's sexual behaviors. But it is interesting to me that, you know, students now have all these workshops and sessions about consent, and yet it does seem like, I don't know if it's getting better. Statistically, it's hard to say, but it does seem that these guys are somewhat immune to all of the teaching, or they arrive at college still expecting to have that party that they've been dreaming about.
So the mother, Eve, wanting some kind of adventure in her life with the new freedom that she has, like she misses her son, she's alone. So she's both lonely, but she also senses this, she has this freedom and she wants to use it. And one of the ways she uses it, as we've discussed, is like watching pornography. But when she goes out to dinner with a younger woman who works on her staff at the Senior Citizen Center, she makes a pass at her, which is rejected. And this is the first time she's ever even thought of the possibility of having a relationship with a woman. And when she's rejected, it's kind of devastating. It's like, okay, I tried freedom. Like, what did I think I was doing? Like, apparently I can't do that. Apparently I've made a terrible mistake. Now I'm just really embarrassed. It's inappropriate to, she thinks, as like the boss to have made a pass at someone who works for her. And she says, like, that's sexual harassment. Like, why did I do that? And she's just heartbroken and disappointed in herself and also inhibited by the response that she's gotten. And I thought it was interesting for you as a male writer to try to really get deep into this woman's head while trying out for the first time a lesbian relationship.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it really was coming from that sense that once she starts looking at porn, certain things in real life look different to her. So she's watching all this porn where a confident, experienced woman is seducing a woman who is sort of reluctant, I guess is the word that's used in the book. There's a confident one and a reluctant one. And she's having this wonderful dinner with her employee, and it's kind of flirtatious, and they're discussing sex and they're discussing gender. And she keeps feeling like the gravity of this porn scenario. It's like, oh, you know, which one of us is the confident one? Which one of us is the reluctant one? And somehow, I think this is really what the book is about. It's during this fall that most of the action takes place in, Eve is feeling her life becoming a kind of a porn scenario or a series of porn scenarios. And they do cause her to act in ways that she never would have acted before and ways that go against her principles. And one of the things that she says, and that I do think is absolutely true, is in porn, there's no such thing as sexual harassment. Anytime a kind of illicit situation is set up, it's so that the doctor can have sex with the patient, so the babysitter, you know, can get together with the parents who've come home, you know. There's no sexual harassment in porn. And so just for a second, I think Eve mistakes her life for a porn scenario. And then when, you know, cold water gets splashed on her, it's like she's waking from a dream. Like what was I doing? What was I thinking? And I am very interested in those moments when people do things that run contrary to their deepest principles, to their sense of right and wrong. Those are the moments, I think, when we find out who we really are.
And are you saying, too, that we sometimes confuse freedom with violating our own principles?
Yeah, that's really interesting, right? That's certainly how it is when we're kids, right? Where we're told you can't do this and you can't do that. And the minute you find yourself alone and unsupervised, those are the things you want to do. And so there is something in that kind of youthful rebellion against our parental strictures that I think, you know, can still affect you when you're an adult. You know, when I remember talking to a friend of mine when our kids had first left for college, and he's a little bit older and his kids had been gone. And I said, oh yeah, we're, you know, going to have an empty nest, you know, pretty soon. And he just looked at me with his sort of wearily and said, well, the pressure to have sex is enormous. You know, it's like the kids leaving was like before when your parents left. Like, you're suddenly free. There's nothing stopping you. And I do feel like Eve is in this moment when, you know, she's alone. She's on her own. And I think she does want to have a sexual life. And she's trying to figure out how to make that happen.
Since you write about turning points in people's lives, what was a big turning point in your life?
Well, I do have to say that going to college was going to college at Yale specifically after growing up where I did in New Jersey. At the time, I was really adamant with myself that I was not going to let this snobby Ivy League world change who I was, and that I could go there, kind of take what it had to offer and emerge kind of unscathed. And what I discovered, and I really tried that. I had a girlfriend at home. I came home a lot on weekends. I always came home for the summers. I always had blue-collar jobs during those summers. But at a certain point in my late 20s, I suddenly realized, you know, I don't eat the same food as my parents anymore. I don't watch the same TV shows as them. I don't read the same books. I feel like there's this distance sometimes between me and older friends. I think that it's just in spite of all of my determination, I had been really transformed by the experience of going to this, elite Ivy League college at that particular point in my life.
How did your parents and how did your old friends react to the changed version of you? Did your parents say, "What happened to you? You're not our son anymore"?
No, you know, my parents were great about it. I think especially my mom, she was the one who really encouraged my siblings and me to go to the best schools we possibly could. And I think she sort of accepted that that transformation. I remember occasionally, my father has been dead for the past 15 years, but I do remember a few times when I was sort of just mocking some TV show he was watching. And I remember, and I thought it was just a dumb show. It was, I can't even remember what it was. And I remember that he turned to me with a really, he was both irritated and wounded, I think, by the fact that I was looking down on the show that he was watching. And you know, I still actually feel bad about that. And you know, that's the part of the transformation in my own life that I'm not crazy about. You know, the sense that the country really is divided by class, and, you know, by virtue of going to an Ivy League school, I did, like, sort of jump social classes. And it's real, you know, there is a kind of condescension that can come with that I, you know, have to really fight in myself.
Well, Tom Perata, thanks so much for talking with us again.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Tom Perata speaking with Terry Gross. His new novel is called Mrs. Fletcher. Like Woody Allen before him, Albert Brooks gave up stand-up comedy to make his own films. Our critic-at-large John Powers considers his 1985 film Lost in America a masterpiece. It's just been released on DVD and Blu-ray by Criterion. Lost in America is the story of a well-heeled L.A. couple, played by Brooks and Julie Haggerty, who decide to become free-spirited wanderers. John just watched it for the umpteenth time and says it's one of the greatest comedies of the last 40 years.
A lot of comedians are funny, but only a handful have the genius to ship the comic terrain. One of them is Albert Brooks, who in a cosmic bad joke is probably best known to today's audiences as the voice of Marlin in Finding Nemo. But back in the early 70s, in a famous Esquire article and a series of legendary Tonight Show performances, Brooks set about gleefully exploding the shticks and traditions of stand-up comedy. Making comedy about comedy, he blazed the trail for such later masters of showbiz meta as Steve Martin, David Letterman, and Bill Murray. By the late 70s, Brooks was making movies, starting with three groundbreaking comedies that explored the triumph of modern narcissism in all its cringeworthy hilarity. The greatest of these is Lost in America, just out in a gorgeous new package from the Criterion Collection that I highly recommend, but also widely streamable. Made at the very height of the Reagan years, Lost in America, co-written with Monica Johnson, feels as relevant to our selfie-mad times as it did in 1985. Brooks stars as David Howard, an L.A. ad man who makes Mad Men's Don Draper look like a figure of Shakespearean grandeur. Living a comfortably middle-class life with his wife Linda, played by Julie Haggerty, the neurotic David is looking forward to a promotion so he can buy a new Mercedes and get an even bigger house. When the promotion is denied, he quits his job in a huff and bullies Linda into quitting hers. He insists they must sell off everything, hit the road, and be free. Here, Linda responds to his idea of getting a mobile home.
Well, what do you think a motorhome cost?
Guess who went motorhome shopping? Hi, friends. Motorhomes for sale, 45,000, yeah. Complete for a great one. 30 uh-huh. feet long, a bedroom, a bath, a kitchen, a microwave that browns, a little TV. Beautiful, beautiful. Better than our new house. It has wheels, too, okay? Now, that leaves us $145,000 in cash. Now, play devil's advocate. Can't you live 20 years on $145,000 if you're living out of a motorhome and just eating and painting and writing books? And, I mean, this is what we talked about when we were 19. Remember, we kept saying, let's find ourselves. Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't have a dollar, so we watched television instead. Linda, this is just like Easy Rider, except now it's our turn. I mean, we can drop out and we can still have our nest egg. I just think that's unheard of.
Before we know it, the two are cruising east in their Winnebago, doing their own cushy version of Easy Rider. But when they stop to get remarried in Las Vegas, all that bursting neon unleashes unforeseen consequences, including a classic encounter between David and a casino boss played by the late Gary Marshall. From that point on, David and Linda find themselves living in a reality far different to the one they imagined, and far funnier, in part because its stars are so perfectly matched. Brooks is one of the most majestic ranters and kvetchers in movie history, and his verbal mania is only fueled by Haggerty's googly-eyed daffiness. Now, Brooks's comic approach is unsentimental, and often uncomfortable. David may be all too human, Brooks clearly sees something of himself in the guy, but he's far from lovable. Indeed, pointing the way to curb your enthusiasm, Brooks's work creates the prototype of the annoyingly selfish hero who stews in anxiety, bad faith, and a sense of always being right. When Lost in America came out, it was instantly recognized as a trenchant satire of the emerging species known as yuppies, with their materialism, sense of entitlement, and unidealistic belief that the world is their oyster. What was less clear then was that Brooks was also the first filmmaker to capture the essence of bourgeois bohemianism, the attempt to embrace the cool lifestyle of the rebel while still having money and comfort. That fantasy is alive and kicking among today's urban strivers who play vinyl, go glamping, and drink artisanal coffee as they try to make their millions. While David and Linda are actually uneasy riders, they don't know how to change their lives. The road they travel isn't Easy Rider's dreamy America either. At one point, they have a fight in front of the Hoover Dam. This is partly a visual gag about scale. Their personal squabbling is dwarfed by the dam. But we also sense the gap between the grandeur of this Depression-era triumph of the collective spirit and the debased landscape they travel in, with its mini-malls and Der Wiener Schnitzel fast-food restaurants. If there's more to America than this, they can't see it. Which isn't to say that they don't learn anything from being on the road. On the contrary, they find out who they really are, and how they really want to live. And this self-knowledge leads to a wickedly upbeat ending that includes the greatest gag ever about finding a parking space in Manhattan. David and Linda only stop being lost in America when they find out that, given the choice, they'd rather be comfortable than free.
John Powers is TV and film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. Some of America's most popular breakfast cereals, like Corn Flakes and Rice Krispies, have a history that intersects with the Seventh-day Adventists, the early wellness movement, eugenics, sexual abstinence, and some innovative as well as some horrifying medical interventions. Not something you'd suspect from the popular jingles.
Kellogg's, good morning, the best to you each morning. K-E-L-L-O-double good Kellogg's, best to you.
Our next guest, Dr. Howard Markel, is the author of the new book, The Kellogg's, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. It's about Dr. John Kellogg and his younger brother, Will. John, the doctor, was groomed to be a leader of the Seventh-day Adventists. In 1876, he became director of their sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan, which he turned into a world-famous medical center, spa, and grand hotel that attracted many celebrities. In 1921, his research on diet and digestion was nominated for a Nobel Prize. As part of his dietary research, Dr. Kellogg and his brother created a new idea, ready-to-eat cereals like cornflakes. Will, who was the business innovator, turned those breakfast cereals into good-tasting, mass-produced popular breakfasts marketed under the Kellogg brand. He founded the company in 1906. Although the two brothers worked together for a long time, they never got along, and their relationship ended with a series of lawsuits. Howard Markel directs the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan, where he's also professor of pediatrics and communicable diseases. Terry spoke with him last Tuesday.
Dr. Howard Markel, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to write a book about the Kellogg brothers?
Oh, my. Well, there's a lot of reasons. But if you grew up in Michigan, as I did, you could not help but be aware of the Kelloggs. Every first grader, and I was one of them in 1966, would make a field trip to the Battle Creek factory where they made Kellogg's cornflakes. And we were all given a Tony the Tiger bowl, which I still own, and a little box of sugar Frosted Flakes, which was consumed long before we turned back to the suburbs of Detroit. And then, of course, there's the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, so you see the beneficence of the Kellogg family everywhere you turn. And when I was in medical school, I used to study in the library. And in between cramming the Krebs cycle or this physiological fact into my head, I would take a break. And I often paused at the section where Dr. Kellogg's books and magazines, his monthly magazine called Good Health, were stored. And I would take them down and read them and have fun with that. And I thought at that time, you know, somebody ought to write a book about these two fellas, never realizing it would be me.
It's funny, you know, breakfast cereals now are often considered basically sugar-coated vitamin pills because the fortification of vitamins is the nutrition and the sugar is what gets kids to eat it, but it's not very good for them. But breakfast cereals were originally part of a health craze that Dr. Kellogg created. Why was breakfast such a problem? Like if you weren't into health like Dr. John Kellogg was, what were the problems with breakfast as he saw it?
Well, there were a number of issues. And yes, cornflakes, wheat flakes, flake cereal in general were invented to be easily digested by those with upset stomachs or what was then called dyspepsia, the great American stomach ache. And if you look at what people ate in America in the late 19th century or even the early 20th century, it was very heavy in animal fats, often cured meats, so they're very salty, a lot of sugar. And making breakfast was an ordeal. So even if you made porridge or mush, these whole grains took hours to melt down and make into a mush or a soft form. And so these poor mothers were getting up very early. They were probably taking care of all their children all night. They had to start a wood-burning fire, and so making breakfast was a great ordeal. But John Harvey Kellogg invented them for the invalided people who came to his Battle Creek Sanitarium. It was his little brother, Will, who realized, you know, there are a lot more people who are healthy and just want a convenient, tasty breakfast than those who are ill and need an easily digestible breakfast. So he added a little sugar, a little salt to cornflakes, and it just took the world by storm in 1906 because you could simply pour breakfast out of a box. Even Dad could make breakfast now.
So these cereals started off as part of a larger health regimen that Dr. Kellogg prescribed. You credit him with coming up with the concept of wellness. He ran a sanitarium. So give us an overview of some of the beliefs that he had about wellness that actually became popular.
Well, Dr. Kellogg called it wellness. He called it biologic living. And he was really prescient about this. And don't forget, at the turn of the last century, most doctors were fixated on diseases, not preventing them, but treating them once they occurred. And back then, it was often once they occurred and were around for a long period of time, so they did their damage. Dr. Kellogg was all about preventing these diseases before they ever happened by living a healthy life, and that included exercise, a lot of vigorous physical activity, eating a grain and vegetable diet, avoiding animal fats or meats, or as he called it, flesh eating, avoiding that, no alcohol, no caffeine of any kind. He also was very chaste and reminded his both his readers and his followers that sex outside the marriage, of course, was not a good idea, but sex for anything other than procreation really sapped the soul and sapped the spirit. And of course, he was very much opposed to masturbation of any kind, something he wrote about extensively and called the solitary vice.
So Battle Creek is famous for Kellogg's and for Post, another big breakfast cereal company, but it's also famous as, at the time, the home center, like the home base for the Seventh-day Adventists. And Dr. Kellogg, John Kellogg, was very close to co-founders of Seventh-day Adventism, Ellen and James White. And they saw him when he was a child as being a possible leader of the church in the future. So what was his relationship with the church?
Well, you're right. Battle Creek was basically the Vatican of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And John Harvey, even as a young boy and a young man, just exuded brilliance and was curious about everything. And so the Whites, who were the co-founders of the denomination, Ellen White was a prophetess, a self-proclaimed prophetess, and they realized this young man was quite special. So they groomed him, and a big part of Seventh-day Adventism and many Christian denominations in the mid-19th century was about health reform, about keeping your body clean and chaste and free of vice, and also dietary issues as prescribed in the Old Testament. And he later came to edit their magazine called The Health Reformer, which John Harvey later changed the name to Good Health because he realized that people don't like reform. They like to be healthy, but they don't want somebody telling them to reform. And so they realized that John Harvey could be the head of their health avenue, their health section of the denomination. Now, the Whites founded what became the Battle Creek Sanitarium, which was a world-famous medical spa, grand hotel, and medical center. But they called it the Western Health Reform Institute. It was basically a house where quacky doctors lectured about things and served bad food and people didn't come back. But they realized that John Harvey could be the new leader, but he had to get a good medical education. And when he came back to Battle Creek, he was tapped to take over the Western Health Reform Institute. And he said, I'll do so on one condition, that I get to run it, and I get to run it not only on religious principles, but on scientific principles, because he wanted desperately not only to be a good Seventh-day Adventist, but to be well-regarded in the medical profession. People from all around the world came to Battle Creek to heal.
Some famous people, too. Who were some of the famous people who came?
Well, he treated many presidents, including Warren Harding and William Taft. He treated William Jennings Bryan, the Democratic hopeful. He treated Eddie Cantor, the comedian. He treated Johnny Weissmuller, Tarzan, who would go into the dining room and do a Tarzan yell to begin the meal. He treated Amelia Earhart and Sojourner Truth he treated and on and on and on. There was a rupture between John Harvey Kellogg and the Whites that began probably
the Whites being the co-founders of the church.
Yes, Ellen and James White, the co-founders of the church. And the rupture probably began as soon as John took over the sanitarium. He was a very headstrong guy. He always knew he was right, even when he wasn't. Because he was so charismatic and brilliant, he often was right. But he did not want people who were not medically trained telling him how to run his hospital or his medical center. And he certainly didn't want people who were trying to run it from afar. You know, the Whites were often wintering in California, and of course there were other elders of the Adventist Church who looked at the profits that the sanitarium was making. Now, it all went back into the sanitarium, but they wanted some of that money for other Adventist projects and programs. And so John was very tight-fisted with the money he brought in and the ideas he was propagating. And eventually, there was a deep rupture and a whispering campaign that John was taken over by the devil that became a shouting campaign. And in 1905, he was excommunicated from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the very church he grew up in and was raised to become a leader in.
Okay, so let's get back to cereal. Will was the marketing genius behind Kellogg's cereals. He was also in on the early recipes of them. And he had worked with his brother at the sanitarium as the business guy there, figuring out, you know, I guess all the accounting stuff and, you know, making the business end work. And he was very innovative on that front. But he was considered the dim brother when they were kids. He was 8 years younger.
Yes, and John, as the older brother, never missed an opportunity to pick on or humiliate his younger brother from childhood on. In his old age, Will said, what I remember most about my childhood is that I shared a bed with John and he would warm his cold feet on my back during the winter. And he would push him and make fun of him. And of course, when Will worked for him for almost 25 years as his administrative aide. John did all sorts of mean things. He had him run beside him as John rode his bike across the campus and Will had to take notes or dictation. When John went to the bathroom to have a bowel movement, he made Will come in and take notes so he wouldn't waste a moment, long before LBJ was doing that to his White House aides. And he didn't pay him well and he didn't treat him well. Yet Will was this business genius who knew how to run a very large organization, not only keep accounts but come up with new methods to keep accounts in a better way. He was brilliant at human resources because you had thousands of employees doing all sorts of different tasks. You couldn't find a better tutorial for running an international corporation like the Kellogg Cereal Company than by running the Battle Creek Sanitarium for so many years. It's just that the psychic costs of being made fun of and treated as a lackey was very difficult for Will's psyche.
The two brothers, John and Will, fought to the end. And one of the things they fought about was the brand name of Kellogg.
Yeah, so as soon as poor Will became successful, and John Harvey sold him the rights and made a mint off of cornflake stock, he started making his own cereal and calling it Kellogg's. And of course, Will, by this time, had advertised to a fare-thee-well. This was beginning around 1909, and he was investing, you know, millions of dollars a year in ads. And he felt that another Kellogg-named product that was not nearly as tasty as his product would harm his company. And to some extent, to a large extent, he was right. So he sued John Harvey, and then John Harvey sued Will. And this lawsuit, it went for almost a decade, going all the way to the Michigan State Supreme Court. And the basic question was, who had the right to use the name Kellogg on a box of cereal? Now, going for John Harvey's case, you know, he was more famous. He was a world-famous doctor. He wrote books. He was a best-selling author. People came to see him for his digestive advice. He thought he was the guy. And Will said, well, no, wait a minute. Everybody who hears the name Kellogg's thinks of cornflakes now. And by that time, this is, you know, early 1920, they did. And the judges agreed with Will, and he won the case. And poor John Harvey had to pay all the legal costs and everything else. And he could only put his name in tiny writing on the bottom of the box for any cereal he created. And of course, it was very easy to steal a patent for cereal, as the Kellogg's learned. All you have to do is change one little step, and then you can't really be sued by the person who holds the patent. So Will later made a mint off of brand cereals, even though that was truly John Harvey's creation. But the two, you know, there was a lot of bad blood between them. And then after the lawsuit, they rarely, if ever, spoke to one another again. Will made sure there was always a witness when they did speak to each other because he never knew what John Harvey would say about him.
So I have to tell you, when I was growing up, Battle Creek was this kind of mythic place for me because, you know, I'd have breakfast cereals for breakfast. And whether it was Post or Kellogg's, the address would be Battle Creek. And I would like stare at the cereal boxes when I had breakfast. and there wasn't much to read on them, so you're always seeing the name Battle Creek. And then there was always like a come on the boxes where, like, if you wrote to the address in Battle Creek, you'd get a free something or another, you know,
right,
a souvenir of the cereal. And so it would all lead back to Battle Creek. And I had no idea what that was or what it meant, though it sounded like a really interesting name. Battle Creek.
Yeah.
Like, who knew what kind of battles went on there that helped produce these cereals?
Yeah.
Since you lived close to Battle Creek and actually took school trips there, was it a mythical place in your mind? You saw the reality of it.
Well, in 1966 it was, because Cereal City was in full operation. So
Cereal City, is that what it was called?
Yeah, that's what they called it, Cereal City. And, if you were a Michigan boy, as I was, you took two big field trips. One was to the Ford Motor Company in Dearborn, Michigan, which also had a mythical sensibility to many children. But you took a trip to Battle Creek. So you went into this factory, which was pristine, and everyone was wearing white, and there was stainless steel devices all chugging and moving and doing stuff. And there were these conveyor belts. Literally, there were 5 miles of conveyor belts in the factory that went all the way from the granary, where they took raw corn or wheat or what have you. And you follow this path with a tour guide all the way to the boxing room, where you had fresh boxes of cornflakes or sugar frosted flakes or what have you. And the smell was overpowering. I still remember that smell of toasted corn. And then they gave you a fresh box. And that fresh box was the best box of cereal I've ever had. And to some extent, I'm still searching for that wonderful fresh box of cereal.
Well, Howard Markel, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks so much, Terry. It's just been thrilling to have the opportunity to speak with you today.
Howard Markel is the author of the new book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer this week is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Saman, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.